If our fate is tied to our, stopping from being gross, repugnant, arrogant, cruel, wasteful, and excessive, then I suggest to you that on December 21st, 2012, or in that window, we're really going to rock on. Sorry for the poor analogy there, but that's kind of what I think. We're not exactly headed in the right direction. Science is only just now, as are many of you out there that listen to this program, beginning to toy around the edges of consciousness and what it means. We're going to have to get a lot further than that, or we rock on. We'll be right back. A little bit of a warning right now. We're about to enter an area that's going to be very controversial. It's going to make a lot of people angry, and that's just the way it goes. That's what this program does. What's left of the rainforest has and is yielding some drugs that modify one's thinking. They modify, perhaps might even be suggested, one's consciousness. It begins to change a person, the use of these drugs. Drugs like DMT, we've talked about them on this program before. I believe that mind-altering drugs are made illegal in this country and other Western countries because they tend to change people's minds. They take people, it is suggested or believed, away from productivity. And in our economy, in our country, we want to be productive, don't we? And that's the basis, I believe, of these laws against these drugs. Now, it may not be widely known, or perhaps it is, but Graham has experimented rather extensively with a number of these drugs. Tell us about it, Graham.
Yes. Well, let me preface that remark by saying something, and you're right. I mean, what we're going to talk about now will anger a lot of people because, unfortunately, in our society, we have been conditioned by a kind of mind control program, a very sinister and a very dark mind control program. And part of this mind control program is the so-called war on drugs, so that most of us have grown up unable to think freely and independently about such issue. We hear the word drug, and we automatically assume that it's a bad thing. And if we're to say anything good about drugs, then immediately we arouse instinctive, instant anger from millions of our fellow citizens.
Evil,
yes. And what we have to, you know, what we have to understand is that this comes from an extremely clever and skillful program that has manipulated us into ways of thinking that may be contrary to our own interests, but beneficial to the interests of the powers that be, beneficial to the interests of those who control our lives, who tax us until we have hardly a penny left to spend, and who take our money and plow it into the creation of huge armed bureaucracies which exist to oppress us. I'd like to say at the outset, I do have very strong views on this issue, and I think it's outrageous in a supposedly free society after 2,000 years of progress towards so-called democracy that we live in a society today where we may not make the decision as adults privately, in our own homes, doing no harm to others. We are not allowed to make the decision to explore our own consciousness through the use of ancient and sacred plants that have been used in shamanistic cultures for tens of thousands of years. If I am not sovereign over my own consciousness, then I am sovereign over nothing. And it's an absurd joke to talk about democracy and the wonders of democracy when I live in a society that will not allow me to explore my own mind using tools and techniques that have been used by mankind for tens of thousands of years. But that is the society that we live in today. And rather than being outraged and angry about this, we've been lulled into a sense of security, false security. We've been told that our governments are acting in our interest to protect and preserve our health, when in fact what they're doing is infringing on the very essence of ourselves, upon our consciousness. I'm not here to advocate drugs. I know that many drugs are harmful and dangerous, but I am here to advocate adult personal responsibility. And unfortunately, we now live in a society where adults are not allowed to take responsibility for their own lives, where bureaucrats and social workers interfere with our lives in every way and tell us what we may or may not do, and even enter the inner sanctum of our own consciousness and tell us what we do there. And it's utterly disgusting to me that we live in a society that can throw, as I said earlier, 24-hour-a-day completely meaningless and mindless television at us, which, of course, is affecting our consciousness in all sorts of negative ways. And that is okay, but that we may not experiment with ancient and sacred plants such as peyote, such as the ayahuasca brew from South America, such as iboga from Central Africa, which have been used in shamanistic ceremonies to explore the supernatural realm for tens of thousands of years. Something terrible has gone wrong with the society we live in, and our own money, our own tax dollars are being turned against us, funding huge armed bureaucracies that may enter our homes, that may deprive us of our property, that may put us in jail, not because we did any harm to anybody else, but simply because we chose to explore our own consciousness. And I think any right-thinking citizen, any free-thinking individual should be outraged and should shout with anger at what is happening to us today and about how this is being allowed to continue.
All right, then straight out, you have experimented with these drugs rather extensively. What?
I have. I found that I needed to do so in order to research and write my book, Supernatural.
And having done so?
Having done so, I can honestly say that it has changed my life, that it has transformed the direction of my life. Now, I'm not talking about heroin or cocaine. I've never taken cocaine in my life. I have no interest in doing so. I'm not going to put down anybody who does, but personally, that's not for me. I'm not interested in something that doesn't expand my consciousness, and I don't believe that cocaine does that. I'm not interested in addictive drugs. I don't want to become hooked and dependent on some substance. But what I'm interested in is certain plants that have been regarded as sacred, as teachers of mankind down the ages by shamans in tribal and hunter-gatherer societies. And amongst those plants, I'm most particularly interested in a brew, a drink that is prepared in the Amazon. We have archaeological evidence of the use of this brew. It's called ayahuasca. It means the vine of souls. Archaeological evidence of its use going back more than 3,000 years in the Amazon. It's probably much older than that. It's a combination of two different plants. One of them is a vine, the ayahuasca vine, and the other are the leaves of a bush, and the bush is called chacruna in the Amazon, and its botanical name is Cicotria viridis. And these leaves contain large quantities of the potent and, in this society, illegal hallucinogen called DMT, dimethyltryptamine. Now, the interesting thing about DMT, and again, I want to emphasize to your audience that none of these hallucinogenic substances are addictive in any way. It's impossible to become addicted to them. That DMT can be taken and effective in the human body by smoking it or, in fact, by injecting it. And it produces a very short 12-minute journey into other realms. But it cannot be normally absorbed orally. So that leaf that I told you about, the Cicotria viridis bush from the Amazon, you could sit down and munch your way through 1,000 leaves from that bush, or you could brew them up into a tea and drink them, and it wouldn't have any effect on you whatsoever. And that's because there's an enzyme in our stomachs, monoamine oxidase, which actually destroys DMT.
Having done it properly, can you describe the experience?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to add that the other ingredient, the vine, contains chemicals that switch off that enzyme in our stomach. And part of the mystery is how the shamans of the Amazon, out of 150,000 different species of plants and trees, ever managed to find these two plants that put together will give us a four-hour journey into supernatural realms. And that is what the experience of ayahuasca is. An extraordinary storm of visions is unleashed behind your eyes. You find yourself leaving this world behind and moving on a journey into a seamlessly convincing parallel universe, a universe that is inhabited by intelligent beings. And indeed, one being in particular, who almost everybody who drinks ayahuasca, it doesn't matter where they come from, they might come from a great city in the West, they might come from the Amazon jungle, they will meet this being. She is always recognized as a female spirit. And she is the spirit of ayahuasca itself. And very frequently, most frequently of all, she takes the form of a gigantic snake, a serpent. Sometimes she takes the form of a human form, as a beautiful woman. Sometimes of a mass of serpents. She conveys messages to you, messages of deep concern with the environment, messages of the fragility of the planet on which we live, of the fragility of the human adventure on this planet. Everybody who drinks ayahuasca will meet this being and sense that we are dealing with a loving entity here which holds the planet in her coils and exists to protect and preserve this planet, but at the same time has the time to pay attention to individual human lives, to enter into contact with individuals, to teach them. Professor Benny Shannon, he's the professor of psychology at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Benny has drunk ayahuasca more than 300 times. That's a lot more than I've drunk it. I've drunk it 25 times. He's compiled the experiences of hundreds of people around the world who have drunk ayahuasca, and all of them speak of it as a teacher. It's like entering a school where you start to learn lessons that will transform your life. You examine your own behavior, the minutiae of your own behavior, how you act towards other people, how you may sometimes be cruel or unkind or thoughtless towards others. You're shown the truth about yourself in a very clear way. And you're given the opportunity to change yourself. And if you don't change yourself, the next time you drink ayahuasca, you will be shown those truths again, very clearly and very painfully. And this has happened to me again and again in my ayahuasca experiences. And I like to think, although it's a difficult process to change a lifetime of bad habits, that ayahuasca has set me on a journey to improve myself, to make me a better person, to make me more loving and caring towards my fellow human beings, and which has greatly heightened my sense of the environment, of what is happening to the earth today, of the horror that is being unleashed in the Amazon. It's made me care about these things in ways that that I never did before. And most important of all, it's absolutely convinced me that our consciousness is not simply an artifact of our brains, generated accidentally by our brains as we go about our material business, that our consciousness is immortal, that we lived before we came into this life, that we will continue to live after we die in these physical bodies, that there are realms beyond our own, dimensions beyond our own, that they're all around us all the time, so close to us that they interpenetrate us, and yet normally we don't access them, we don't see them. And that's because of our state of consciousness.
Graham, let me just stop you and say that the commonality of this experience that you've described truly is leaving me speechless.
Yeah.
That commonality is just, it's impossible, or it's real.
Well, it's real. This is the thing. Generally speaking, because we're wedded to the materialist paradigm in this society, we're convinced sure. that there is only material reality and that there is nothing else beyond that. If large numbers of human beings all see the same things, then we tend to, in the material world, then we tend to agree that those things are real. But our society and our scientists tell us that so-called hallucinations, so-called visions, are not real, that these are just figments of our imagination, the result of disturbed brain chemistry, that we're sort of cooking up this imagery in our own mind. Now, if the conventional theories of hallucinations were correct, then everybody would see different things in
yes.
states of consciousness. They would not see the same things, but astonishingly and stunningly, it doesn't matter where you come from, what your cultural background is, what your personal biography is. Doesn't matter if you come from the jungle or from the city, you are going to see the same things in ayahuasca visions, and you are going to encounter the same intelligent beings with the same messages for mankind. And yet our scientists, of course, themselves, they've never drunk ayahuasca, they've never had any experience of these kind of visions, and yet they are arrogant enough to say that those of us who have these visions and those experiences are simply deluded fools who are experiencing illusions. What I would say is that when hundreds and thousands of people from all around the world see and encounter the same intelligent supernatural beings in altered states of consciousness, that should tell us that these experiences are real.
Yes, but scientists claim that repeatability is truth.
Yes. Repeatability is truth, and, so, and repeatability is truth, and this is what you know. Again, it's almost impossible to explore this idea in our society. We see there's a huge popularization of the supernatural on the media, on television. It's the subject of so many cheap and trashy TV shows, and you know, people try to invent machines, you know, so-called ghost meters and such, in order to contact the supernatural realm. But I think that they will never succeed in doing so by those techniques. That contact with the supernatural is a matter of our state of consciousness. And when we are in the alert problem-solving mode of consciousness, which I think probably represents only about 1% of the potential of our consciousness, but that is the mode that our society wants us to focus our entire energies upon, we are never going to contact these other realms and beings. If we wish to do so, we must alter our state of consciousness. And this is why these ancient and sacred plants, the plant hallucinogens, may in fact turn out to be the single most effective method for repeatedly and in almost in a scientific manner exploring that realm of experience that we call the paranormal and the supernatural, that you can, in a targeted way, enter and return from these other realms again and again and again and pursue your inquiries and contacts and discussions with the beings that live in them.
Yes, but do you understand how our society presently constructed must regard such an experience and a resulting change in attitudes as its enemy?
Well, the powers that be in our society must regard it as its enemy.
Yes.
And those powers that be include the organized religions, of course. They are part of the network of control that keeps us suppressed, that prevents us from realizing our true potential. We don't need organized religions if we as individuals can contact the supernatural realms directly. We do not need the rabbis and the priests and the mullahs to stand as intermediaries between us and the supernatural realm. We can reach those realms by ourselves, as shamans in tribal and hunter-gatherers still consistently do to this day in the Amazon, in the South Africa, for example. We also can do that. We all have this potential as human beings. It is our birthright, and certain plants have co-evolved with us over millions of years to allow us to exercise that birthright. And yet it is seen as a threat by the organized religions. It's seen as a threat by the politicians who are supposed to be our servants, but who arrogantly presume to be our rulers and masters. They wish to tell us what to think, what we are allowed to think, what we may and may not do with our consciousness. And naturally, they are very threatened and fearful at the prospect of individuals taking control of their own lives, taking control of their own destiny, taking control of their own consciousness, taking responsibility for themselves. The state does not wish us to take responsibility for ourselves. It wants to pretend that bureaucratic officials are the only ones who may be responsible for us, that somehow, even though we are adults, we are children who cannot make decisions for ourselves about what we do or do not do with our own bodies and minds. And so it's very threatening for the controlling mentalities who naturally gravitate towards government and positions of power. It's very threatening to them to see individuals taking control of their own consciousness and their own lives. And so a whole A forest of laws and rules has been erected to prevent us from doing that. A whole fearful industry of indoctrination has been set into motion. Huge lies are told to us about this matter so that we become afraid and terrified and confused, when it's always possible for us to think clearly and to act responsibly as adults without the state telling us what to do.
Though mainstream science is not doing a lot in investigating this path, there is some science that's looking at it, and in a moment we will. Good morning, everybody. You're really on a ride this morning. Graham Hancock is my guest. I can assure you, if you live long enough, you'll begin to reflect on some of the things that Graham suggested, that DMT or LSD or ayahuasca or whatever will cause you to reflect very hard on, without perhaps the message from I don't know, the female he spoke about, or perhaps more ominously, the snakes. At any rate, you'll begin to reflect on those things and your life if you live long enough. Apparently, such drugs give you insight into your own behavior to this point in your life, and that which you will change if you live long enough or apparently use one of these. In a moment, the scientific point of view, limited though, although it may be, Dr. Rick Strassman and others have done some research into these drugs, and we'll get to it in a moment. Our brains are supposed to fry on drugs, right? Well, late Terence McKenna was one of the most brilliant men I've ever had the honor to interview. Absolutely brilliant, and he sort of put it all in flames when he came on the air. Every time he came on the air, he talked of DMT. He exhibited brilliance above and beyond just about anything we've ever heard on the air. Graham, I wonder if you knew him.
Sadly, for me, no. I never did know Terence, the late, great Terence McKenna. I never did know him personally. I realized that our work crossed each other at a number of points, intersected at a number of points. I'm a huge admirer of Terence's. I do talk about him in my book, Supernatural. I think he was an extraordinary human being, a real gift from the universe to this planet, a great teacher, a great communicator, a fearless free thinker who truly set out to explore the limits and the potential and the possibility of this mysterious thing that we call our consciousness, which science does not understand.
And for the most part, Graham, what is Dr. Strassman doing?
Well, Rick Strassman is a psychiatrist at the University of New Mexico. He's a personal friend of mine. And he was granted the first license by the federal government in the United States for more than 20 years to conduct research with human volunteers using a powerful hallucinogenic drug. And the drug that Rick Strassman administered to his volunteers was dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which is, as I mentioned earlier, the active ingredient of ayahuasca. And Rick worked with his volunteers over a period of nearly a decade during the 1990s, giving them dimethyltryptamine by injection. And I've taken DMT in pure form, of course, as well as in the ayahuasca brew. And whereas in the case of ayahuasca, you are dealing with a journey that can last up to 4 hours, in the case of pure DMT, as Rick administered to his volunteers, you're dealing with a journey that might last 20 minutes at the outset, at the most, and frequently even less than that, 12 or 15 minutes. And it's like mounting yourself on the nose cone of a space rocket and being fired off into not the universe, but into a parallel realm, into another world that is unique and extraordinary in its strangeness.
You mentioned time. Is there on the part of the experiencer, is there a sense of time? Does one know that he's been on a 12 to 20 minute trip versus 4 hours?
The only sense of time is this, that when you go into the DMT experience, which sometimes can be extremely disorienting and terrifying, the one thing that certainly I find reassuring is the knowledge that I will be out of there again relatively soon. That it's not going to go on for hours and hours and hours. But actually, when you're in the experience itself, you are removed from this time frame. Mm-hmm. Removed from it completely. Interestingly enough, the Mexican shaman Maria Sabina, back in the 50s, who used to work with psilocybin mushrooms, called these realms that you go into the world where everything is known. And in this world where everything is known, you're outside the frame of material time. It's technically possible for you to encounter people from the past or from the future in this realm, and certainly I've had the sense of that with ayahuasca and with DMT. But it is It is in the back of your mind because you do never lose completely that still small voice of your own reason. It is in the back of your mind reassuring to know that you won't be there forever, that you will come out of it and come back to this realm in which you were born and brought up and where you feel grounded and sure and secure. But the DMT worlds, and I think there's more than one of them, are astonishingly eerily strange. There's something oddly technological about them. When I took DMT, and this accords very much with the experiences reported by Rick Strassman's volunteers and, of course, by Terence, I found myself in a strangely technological world, a room with no clear walls, and yet a sense of glass or crystal planes surrounding the room, a room in which small intelligent beings moved around at high speed, a sense that I was downloading a huge amount of information, of a vast quantity of information just pouring into my mind at an unbelievable speed, so much that it was overwhelming, that I couldn't understand it, that I couldn't read it, that the sense that it might take me a lifetime to process it, and the sense of contact with alien entities, with entities that are not of this world, not of this planet.
I was just about to say that. It's sounding an awful dimension. Lot like that.
Yeah. A real sense of contact with beings that are not of this world, and the sense of an information transfer and information flow. And this was one of the curious discoveries. I use the word alien quite deliberately. This was one of the curious discoveries that Rick Strassman made during his research. That very large numbers of his volunteers, although we know that they were not physically abducted, mm-hmm. because they were in fact lying in front of Dr. Strassman on a hospital bed in the University of New Mexico. Very large numbers of them reported experiences that were virtually identical with the alien abduction experience that has been reported so extensively over the last few decades. To cut a long story short, Rick is suggesting that people who have the alien abduction experience, and I just need to preface this by saying that, by the way, all of us have DMT in our own bodies. DMT is produced naturally in the human body. It's produced in the pineal gland. And Rick was suggesting that those who've had the alien abduction experience are people who spontaneously overproduce DMT. And put themselves into an intensely altered state of consciousness, which then allows them access to these other realms and beings. Rick is very clear to stress that he is not saying that the experience is caused by or manufactured by or produced by the drug, but rather that the drug allows the experience into the mind, allows us access to the experience, makes the experience possible. And he's suggesting, he actually calls DMT the spirit molecule, that it gives us access to spirit realms. He believes that it plays a part not only in alien abduction experiences, but also in near-death experiences, that it gives us access to the world beyond. And I think Rick's work has given us a quantum leap forward in the understanding of this mysterious phenomenon that we call alien abductions today.
Well, how in the world else do you explain the commonality of the experiences? That's where I'm stuck, I think.
It's the commonality that is utterly convincing. And what I've tried to show in my book, Supernatural, is that this commonality is not confined to our generation and to this time and place. It's not simply a commonality that people who've never compared notes, from America or Britain or Australia or the Amazon, mm-hmm. share, but also a commonality that is shared across huge periods of history, and that people have been having these experiences going back tens of thousands of years, and that in fact they even documented these experiences on the walls of the painted caves in Upper Paleolithic Europe more than 30,000 years ago, in the rock shelters of South Africa and of Australia. exactly the same beings that Rick Strassman's volunteers reported encounters with, that people who have had the alien abduction experience report encounters with. These beings were also being painted more than 30,000 years ago in deep caves in Europe and Africa and Australia.
Is all of this somehow encoded in our DNA?
This is an interesting mystery, and again, I explore this at length in Supernatural, much more at length than we can go into here. And can I just take the opportunity, since we're roughly midway through, just to say that I am, just to remind listeners, I am on a lecture tour. I will be talking tomorrow at the Bodhi Tree in Los Angeles. I'm traveling all over the United States. The details of the tour are on my website, which is www.grahamhancock.com. Go to the talks, workshops, and events page, and every event that I'm doing and the location is listed there. And, of course, there's much more details about my book, Supernatural, there as well.
Well, we're glad to have you here in the country, and I imagine you're going to do very well on the tour.
Well, I hope so. I find it very stimulating. I find it very stimulating to engage in questions and answers. And, you know, we were talking earlier about the transformation of consciousness, and one thing that's clear to me as I travel around the United States is that there are huge numbers of incredibly good-willed, decent and kind-hearted, open-minded, free-thinking people in this country. And this ultimately, I believe, will be the salvation of the United States and of the world.
Well, I hope you're right. You know, they are not regularly reported by the media, so we don't hear a lot about
it. We don't hear a lot about it, but good people are out there everywhere. And although the United States may be operating in a very harmful and negative way on the world stage at the moment, inside the United States, there are people who are deeply troubled by this and deeply troubled by the behavior of their own government. Of course, I'm speaking also of Britain, because Britain and the United States are in this together. And the same is true in Britain. More and more of us are deeply concerned by what our governments are doing with our money and supposedly in our name, and deeply concerned by the tyranny and oppression of the individual that is the characteristic and hallmark of these governments, and what a tragedy it is after a 2,000-year struggle towards democracy that we've given it all up for so little in the modern age.
And this attitude is exactly what makes these things the enemy of the powers that be.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There is a real struggle here, and it's time for individuals to take control of their own lives again and to say that we as adults do not need to be told what to do by bureaucrats and officials. We as adults must take responsibility ourselves for our own lives and for our own consciousness, and really the mystery of consciousness.
Now, perhaps like the tea, we should be dumping DNA into the water.
Well, yes, you started with the question on DNA, and
yes.
This is one aspect of the problem that I do explore at some length in Supernatural.
Actually meant DMT, but I do want to talk about DNA. So
yeah,
is it somehow
DMT? Yes.
Yeah, is it somehow encoded in our DNA? In other words,
yeah.
When DMT meets DNA, is that producing some commonality, or is it far?
Well, it's possible, and I think it's part of the mystery. You see, the mystery and the problem is, why is it that people from all over the world, all different cultures, different periods of history, separated from one another by huge geographical distances and by thousands of years in time, in undergoing experiences that our scientists today say are illusory and non-real, why is it that all these people actually have the same experiences and see the same things and learn this, are taught the same lessons by the beings that they encounter? And one explanation, and it's an explanation that I strongly favor, is that the spirit worlds that shamans talk about are real. They are not illusions. They are other dimensions. Quantum physics is really just beginning to get to grips with this. Shamans have been getting to grips with it for thousands of years. They are other dimensions that surround and interpenetrate our own. But another intriguing explanation that I also explore in Supernatural is that there may be information written on our DNA, a kind of teaching program, a huge message for us, for the human race, and that it is this message that we access in altered states of consciousness. And in fact, these two points of view may not be mutually contradictory. It may be that the physical and the material world is a creation of the spirit world. After all, that's what all religions essentially say. It may be that the physical world is created by the spirit world, and that DNA, which is the essence of physical life, may in fact be a creation of spirit realms and spirit beings to allow non-physical consciousness to incarnate in physical form.
Well, perhaps so. Graham, we have unraveled most of the mystery of our DNA, but there is this term. There is this term scientists have called junk.
Junk DNA. Exactly.
Junk DNA.
Which happens to be 97% of DNA. And the DNA that we know about, everybody's heard of the Human Genome Project, and we tend to feel reassured and think our scientists know everything about DNA. Actually, they know a lot about only 3% of DNA. And that's the DNA that is involved in our genes, that is gathered together in our genes and that codes for the assembly of amino acids into proteins that build cells, that creates our bodies and the bodies of all living things, plants and animals, on this earth. But the other 97% of DNA, our scientists say, well, that's just junk DNA. It's completely unimportant. It's just random. It's meaningless. As though billions of years of evolution would preserve 97% of something just because 3% of it is important. It's much more reasonable to conclude that the 97% of so-called junk DNA is extremely important as well. And Professor Eugene Stanley at Boston University back in 1994 published a major article in Science magazine, which he still stands by today, which absolutely proves that so-called junk DNA has the same hidden, deep mathematical structure as all human languages. And from this, we may perhaps deduce that a message is indeed written on our DNA. And after all, if, for example, to take the example of an extraterrestrial civilization, we've all heard of the SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Why do we convince ourselves that extraterrestrial intelligences, whether from other dimensions or from this one, would wish to communicate with us by radio? There might be much more effective ways for them to communicate with us. After all, if an alien civilization had been broadcasting a radio message out into the universe for the last 100 million years and had switched that message off in 1890 in our calendar, then none of us would ever have heard it because we didn't develop radio until after 1890. Much more intelligent would be to encode the message on the DNA of all living things and to await the evolution of a being intelligent enough to read that message. And so the one suggestion that I explore is perhaps it is that message that we are all accessing in altered states of consciousness. Perhaps we are accessing a teaching program that gets switched on at a certain stage in evolution, and perhaps that stage is now.
So that commonality could be the contact we've been looking for externally.
Exactly. It could be the contact we've been looking for externally, and it's been inside us all the time. And in order to access it, we must enter an altered state of consciousness. And that would then explain why everybody has these astonishingly universal experiences in altered states of consciousness.
Are people changed in a very similar way after these experiences? Is it almost universal or what?
That's what I found, that people are changed in very similar ways and that the bonds of love between them are enormously increased and the sense of barriers and boundaries between people that we erect fall down and fall away, and we sense the oneness and the universality of life.
Well, I tell you, our economy just can't handle it, Graham. All right, Graham Hancock is my guest. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.